Good evening. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you that the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. There happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls. We're going to be talking with Pastor David Whitney tonight about the Constitution and why it is so important, and why there's been a conscious effort not to let the American people understand the importance of our Constitution. There's a lot of discussion today about the confirmation of Judge Roberts to be a member of the Supreme Court to take the place of Sandra Day O'Connor. And certainly the liberals are aligned against Judge Roberts. The conservatives, the Christians, are really lining up solidly behind him. I got just today publications, letters from several of the leading conservative Christian ministries who are led by men that I know and who I trust, who tell me how important it is that Judge Roberts gets into the Supreme Court, and perhaps they're right. I really have not made any firm opinion on my behalf, because all I know is that so much of the information is being intentionally withheld. The Democrats are clamoring to get the various things that Judge Roberts had written while employed by the government, his papers, which of course should be made available so that people can make an intelligent decision on him, that the administration's withholding. What's in there? Is it something that's going to show that he really is a constitutionalist who believes in the strict interpretation of the Constitution and upholding the Constitution, to which he will swear an oath to uphold it against all enemies, foreign and domestic? Or is there something in there that will show that he really is another Justice Souter or Kennedy or like so many of the other Supreme Court justices who have been nominated by Republicans, is really a wolf in sheep's clothing? I don't know. What I do know is that it is very important that we have people on the Supreme Court who do not allow their personal opinions to influence their decisions, because there is a contract between government and the people, and that is the Constitution. That is the very essence of what our freedom is based upon. In fact, we learned in the Declaration of Independence that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and endowed by the Creator with certain unalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And to ensure these rights, governments are instituted among men, depriving their authority from the consent of the governed. That's what our country was all about, and that's why they wrote a constitution. To secure the rights that were laid out in the Declaration of Independence, we established a government. And it was those God-given rights that were laid out in the Declaration of Independence coming from our Creator. Now, it doesn't really matter what I think about abortion. It doesn't really matter what Justice Roberts thinks about abortion. What does the Constitution say about the power of the Supreme, of the Congress? What does the Constitution say about abortion? And, of course, it doesn't address the issue. Specifically doesn't address that issue, because all matters dealing with life, liberty, and property were to be left to the states and to the people. That's what the Tenth Amendment said. That was, of course, what our founding fathers believed, that matters dealing with anything having to do with the individual and their rights was not a matter of the federal government. The Constitution was a limitation on the power of the central government, and it left matters dealing with life, liberty, and property to the states. And, of course, those people who would have a fascist government hate that concept. And we'll be back here in just a moment with Pastor David Whitney to discuss the Constitution. Hi, David. How are you this evening?
Doing great.
Well, let's let you sort of pick up the story. And we've given the introduction, using the confirmation of Justice Roberts, as the issue. But the issue is not Justice Roberts. The issue is the Constitution. Mm-hmm. And how should it be interpreted? Is it a living, breathing document that can be altered by the whim of the judge? Or is the judge to interpret the Constitution as it was written by the original intent?
If it is a living, breathing document, it's basically useless for securing our God-given rights. And perhaps the most important concept to understand in the background of what laid the groundwork for the Constitution and the groundwork for securing our freedoms or liberties under law is the fact that we were established as a Christian nation. And now most people hear that idea and they have been told the lie so long and so repeatedly that they believe that we are not a Christian nation. But if you go back to the very first settlers who came, whether it was Jamestown or Plymouth Plantation, both of those were established as Christian entities in order to establish a society based upon the law of God. For example, the Mayflower Compact, when they wrote that, the very first words are, "In the name of God, amen." and they continue having undertaken for the glory of God and the advancement of the Christian faith and the honor of king and country and so on. So they laid it from the very foundation that this was a Christian settlement. And of course, people say, well, things change between the Puritan forebears and our founding fathers. But not if you read our founding fathers. You read what they said. They were in a continuous stream coming directly from our Puritan forebears. Matter of fact, I don't think it's as appropriate to call the war that was fought to gain our freedom. I don't believe it's appropriate to call it the Revolutionary War. It's more appropriate to call it the War for Independence. Because they were not changing their form of government. Actually, if you read, as we'll talk a little bit further here about the Declaration, which really is the preamble to the Constitution, and you must understand the Declaration if you're going to understand what the Constitution means, because the Declaration states the purposes. The Declaration gives you the why, and the Constitution gives you the how, the details of how this government would work. But if you don't understand that the Constitution is founded upon the Declaration, then you cannot properly interpret and follow the Constitution as it was designed by our founders. When you mention that we're a Christian nation and you talk about established as a Christian nation, you talk about our founders, people immediately say, oh, wait a minute.
Hold that thought right there. But David, we're going to bring on the other stations. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest, of course, is David Whitney, Pastor David Whitney from the Institute of the Constitution. And we're going to be talking about the Declaration of Independence this evening. But David was saying we were founded as a Christian nation. Now, that is very offensive to some people who are not necessarily Christians. They may consider themselves agnostics or atheists, and they consider themselves good Americans. There are people who are Jewish in America, and they would be say that this is not a Christian nation. They don't like the idea it was a Christian nation. And so how do you counter the people who say, well, you know, this is not a Christian nation. We do not want a theocracy in the United States. And yet, when you say Christian nation, you're really not talking about a theocracy, are you?
No, actually, the liberties that people of other religions, such as Jews or other religions, have freedom in our land exactly because we are and were founded as a Christian country. If you go to a truly Muslim country, that is, where the Muslim law is drawn from the Quran, you do not have freedom. You do not have liberty. If you're not a Muslim, you're either a slave, you pay much higher taxes. All your liberties are taken from you if you are not a Muslim in a truly Muslim country governed by the Quran. But in a country governed by the Bible, which is exactly what our founders intended to design, a country governed by God's law recorded in the Bible, you have liberties and freedoms regardless of what your religious beliefs are. Those are secured to you because you are still a creature of the Creator who endowed you with inalienable rights, that is, rights that cannot be taken away by any government, and they're not given to you by a government, they're given to you by your Creator. So it's a whole different ball game if you remove the idea that our rights come from the Creator. And we'll talk about that in a bit, but you know, when you mention that, when you talk about we were founded as a Christian nation and our founders were establishing a Christian constitutional republic, the first objection you hear right away is, oh, no. Oh, the founders, they weren't Christians, they were deists. Well, most people, if you ask them, well, tell me what a deist is, they really can't define it very well, but the deist would believe that God created the universe, he established absolute laws, unchanging laws, both physical laws like gravity as well as moral laws such as the Ten Commandments. And he established these to govern the entire universe, and every person on planet Earth is to be governed by that same set of laws. There isn't a different set of laws for the people in New Guinea and for the people in Bolivia. No, it's the same set of laws. There's God's law that are universal laws. And the deist would agree with all of that, and our founders would agree with that. Where the deist would differ, they'd say, well, God created the universe and then he let it go and he's no longer actively involved with the universe or earth or any human beings whatsoever. He is an absentee landlord, so to speak. He just rented it out and has nothing to do with it any longer. Well, if that were true, then miracles are impossible. No miracles could take place. The deity of Jesus Christ is denied because, obviously, God coming down and becoming a human being would be the greatest violation of the principles of deism, that God is not involved in the universe. If he got directly involved by the birth of Jesus Christ in this world, that would deny deism altogether. Furthermore, prayer would be a waste of time because a God who's not involved in the universe does not answer prayer, in fact, does not listen to prayer. The prayers, so to speak, if they were like a letter sent in the mail, would be returned to sender, undeliverable mail. So a deist would not believe all of those things. They would not believe in the providence of God, that God's involved in the affairs of men. They would not believe that he answers prayer. They would not believe that Jesus Christ is God. Well, just take a look at some of the most often cited deists of our founding father, and that's the other thing. You ask people, well, you say they're all deists. Can you tell me one deist? Quite often people mention Benjamin Franklin as a deist, and it is true. When Franklin was a young man, he espoused some deistic ideas. I don't know that he was really a confirmed, full-fledged, card-carrying deist, but he nonetheless had some ideas along that line. However, by the time he was 80 years old, he was one of the representatives at the Constitution Convention, and the convention got off to a very rocky start. There was a lot of disagreement, a lot of conflict, and very little agreement among the delegates. And on June 28th in the year 1787, Ben Franklin arose and he said this: "In the beginning of the contest with Britain," referring to the War for Independence, "when we were sensible of danger, we had daily prayers in this room for divine protection. Our prayers, sir, were heard, and they were graciously answered." In other words, Ben Franklin, by the time of the Constitution, he was in no way a deist. He believed in prayer to an active living God who was involved in the universe, and that God had answered their prayers. He said, "I have lived, sir, a long time, and the longer I live, the more convincing proofs I see of this truth, that God governs in the affairs of men." Again, a statement a true deist could never make. "And if a sparrow cannot fall to the ground without his notice, is it probable that an empire can rise without his aid? We have been assured, sir, in the sacred writings, that except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. I firmly believe this, and I also believe that without his concurring aid, we shall succeed in this political building no better than the builders of Babel." Wow. Ben Franklin was not a deist at the time of the Constitution Convention.
But, of course, David, the thing people are going to put out is that he never professed a belief in the deity of Jesus Christ. I think he was fascinated with the Christian religion. I think he believed it was the greatest and truest religion of all time. But I don't think that he ever, ever professed his belief in the, in the deity of Jesus Christ as a Christian. So he certainly would not be considered. He was coming from a Christian worldview,
right?
Although he might not necessarily have ever gone that final step of surrendering his life to
exactly.
To our Lord.
And he's not the only one. I think Thomas Jefferson, the same could be said of as well. He did not believe in the deity of Jesus Christ. But the interesting thing, if you read the writings of our founders, even these two, Thomas Jefferson and Ben Franklin, are probably the clearest. They're not what we would say are orthodox Christians, true believers in the Lord Jesus Christ. Yet their understanding of law and government was rooted in the biblical worldview. They saw that God's law is the supreme law of the universe, and every law made by man must be in agreement with the law of the universe, God's law recorded in the Bible, or it's invalid.
And, of course, they were coming from a Christian worldview.
Mm-hmm.
Because all of the people at that time looked at things exactly the same. They looked at the validity of the Bible, as the foundation of all law. So, and if you go through all of the founding fathers, the only two names that really stand out are Jefferson and Franklin. And so if you ever get into this discussion with people, you just ask them to name five of the founding fathers who are not Christians. Well, they will come up with, Franklin and Jefferson. I usually say, other than Franklin or Jefferson, Please give me the names of five. And certainly Thomas Paine is not considered as a founding father of this country by anybody who's ever studied it, because his repudiation of Christianity. So they really can't name any others. And it's a wonderful way then to begin to utilize that as the as an opening statement to presenting exactly what David has just presented. And the fact that on numerous occasions, at least four occasions, the Supreme Court of the United States, even within the 20th century, declared the United States was a Christian nation. So there was no doubt in anybody's mind until 50 years ago that we were a Christian nation. Today, we are no longer a Christian nation. We've become a pagan nation. It's time we took America back.
Amen. Well, Thomas Jefferson, the other claimed deist, was not. Again, people could easily access this. You could refer them to and say, hey, have you read the second inaugural address of Thomas Jefferson? He said this, I shall need the favor of that being in whose hands we are, who led our forefathers as Israel of old from their native land and planted them in a country flowing with all the necessaries and comforts of life, who has covered our infancy with his providence. Now again, providence is the idea that God is actively involved in the daily workings and the details, and he's saying our infancy as a country, that is, the war for independence, was covered by God's providence. A deist could not say that. Then he continued, and our riper years with his wisdom and power, and to whose goodness I ask you to join with me in supplications, that is, prayers, that he will so enlighten the minds of your servants, guide their counsels and prosper their measures, that whatsoever they do shall result in your good and shall secure to you the peace, friendship, and approbation of all nations. He was asking the people of the United States in his second inaugural address to pray for him, to pray that God would give Thomas Jefferson wisdom in all of his decisions and guide all of his counsels and prosper the measures. So here's a man asking for prayer. That's not a deist. And again, if Jefferson was an Orthodox Christian at the end of his life, we are not at all certain of that, but nonetheless, he had a biblical worldview of law and government. Well, we talk about some of the others. For example, if you look at the list of those who attended the Constitution Convention, the delegates, 55 total, 28 were Episcopalians, that is, not just attended the Episcopal Church, these were members of the Episcopal Church, and membership in the Episcopal Church means you signed a doctrinal statement that you believed the doctrine of the Episcopal Church. Now, if you signed such a statement today, it would be worthless as to identify you as an Orthodox Christian, but in that day, the Episcopal Church was soundly Orthodox, and eight more were Presbyterians, seven Congregationalists, two Dutch Reformed, two Lutherans, two Methodists, two Roman Catholics, and then there was one that was unknown in Virginia, not because he was not a Christian, but because we don't know the details. However, he was buried in a churchyard, and in that day, anyone buried in a churchyard was counted as a member of that congregation, so it is likely that he as well was a Christian. And all this is recorded in Bradford's book, A Worthy Company.
All right, fine. Well, I think it's so important that people actually document this for themselves. You can go down to your local courthouse and go to the law library. Ask them to pull out a copy of the case of the Church of the Holy Trinity versus the United States in 1892. And you'll find the Supreme Court gave over 80 reasons as to why the United States was a Christian nation. This is never taught in our schools today. It is never taught in our law schools today. It is never mentioned by our media. Why? Because there are people, of course, who would destroy the Christian foundation of this country and destroy the country. Okay, Dave, why don't you pick up the story from there?
Well, in addition to the fact that these were all members of Orthodox Christian churches, a study was done back in 1984 by two political scientists, Lutz and Heinemann, and they decided that they were going to look at the most significant writings of the Founding Fathers, 15,000 letters, speeches, various correspondence, and so on, to determine, as they studied these 15,000 documents during the founding era, what were the major influences upon the thinking of our founding fathers. And this study was set up very simply to do this. Looking through those 15,000 documents, they were going to discover who the founding fathers were quoting. When there was quotations, they were going to say, where is this quote from? Who is the founding father quoting that they regard as the authority in making the decisions they were making in founding our land? And they discovered an amazing thing, because neither of these were really coming at this from a perspective of the original ideas of our founding fathers. They're just political scientists doing a research that they published in the American Political Science Review in 1984. And they discovered an astonishing thing. 34% of the quotations of our founding fathers came directly from the Bible. More than a third of their quotations in a wide range of their correspondence and speeches came directly from the Bible. And that was astonishing to them. Furthermore, they discovered the second and third and fourth most quoted were people like Montesquieu and Blackstone and Locke, who themselves were interpreting and paraphrasing verses from the Bible. In other words, the most important sources they quoted were the Bible and interpreters of the Bible and what those interpreters of the Bible had to say. Again, this was not what these political scientists expected to find, and they were honest in their research and they published it. So our founders were the major influence on their thinking was the Bible. Most of them, actually you could say all of them, were trained in the Bible from their young age. They learned to their ABCs from the Bible, and they learned to read the Bible as the first and most important book. And even someone like Thomas Jefferson, which we say, well, he's not an Orthodox Christian, yet he studied the New Testament in detail and culled out of the New Testament what he designed as his own book of the aphorisms, the wise sayings of Jesus, and kind of made his own. He didn't make it for publication, actually. He made it just for his own study. So he studied the Bible. He studied it in great detail. Another one of our founders who obviously was a solid Christian is George Washington, although he's been attacked by many who do not believe that. The evidence is very, very clear. Not only was he a vestryman in the Episcopal Church, and that is an officer, like in a Presbyterian church would be an elder or some position like that. So he held office in the Episcopal Church, which means, of course, he signed a statement of faith that he believed the doctrines of the Episcopal Church. He also spoke clearly about his faith in Christ and the importance of following the teachings of Jesus Christ. For example, he spoke to the Indian chiefs in the state of Delaware on the 12th of May in the year 1779, and he said this: "You will do well to wish to learn our ways of life, and above all, the religion of Jesus Christ. These will make you a greater and happier people than you are." Very clearly, a Christian testifying to those who are not Christians that they need to learn the religion of Jesus Christ and follow Jesus Christ. Well, after the War for Independence, when...
David, please hold that. We're going to bring our other stations back online here in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is David Whitney, Pastor David Whitney of the Institute of the Constitution. We're basically talking about the background of the men who created America, and certainly the fact that although there may be questions as to whether Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin were actually born-again Christians, as we would consider today, they were coming from a Christian worldview. They studied the Bible, and that was really the basis of their worldview. In fact, all of the founding fathers read the Bible. That is why it has been so important for the Anti-Christian Lawyers Union, the ACLU, and the other people who hate America and hate our country to get Bible out of our schools and mention of God out of our schools and prayer out of our schools. And then David was going on to say about George Washington and how George Washington was obviously an evangelical Christian, contrary to so much of the propaganda and the lies that are being put up on the internet and taught in our schools today. And the evidence, of course, was that he was an official in his church, and you had to be an avowed and confessed Christian to be a vestryman in the Episcopalian Church, didn't you?
Yes. It's interesting. Visiting Mount Vernon, which is a great tour to visit his plantation, and going through his house, they talk about his daily habits when he was there at Mount Vernon, and they talk about, you know, him rising early in the morning before Martha would get up, and going down the back staircase to his study, which is quite an impressive place with all the books lining the walls and so on, and that he would spend an hour in study. Now, I was curious because the docent there was not really telling us what he studied during that hour, and so I queried, asking, was there a particular book that he studied on a regular basis? And they had to admit, yes, the Bible, and I had read other accounts that George Washington would get on his knees and open the Bible and read and pray for an hour in the morning before starting the day, and then retiring early at night before most other people would go to bed, he would do the same, pray and read God's Word. Here was a devout and godly man, and when he resigned his commission as general, he wrote a letter to all 13 governors of the 13 states resigning his commission, and in that letter of June 8, 1783, he refers to Jesus Christ as the divine author of our blessed religion. There cannot be a clearer testimony of a man who believed in Jesus Christ and was seeking to follow Christ. Then just let me share a few more, because it's important for listeners to gather these snippets of historical facts, because you can go back and find that. You can find George Washington's letter on the internet that he wrote to the 13 governors resigning his commission, and some of these other, for example, Alexander Hamilton. He urged the formation, after the Constitution Convention, he urged the formation of a Christian constitutional society. Its purpose was to preserve the values essential to this nation. In other words, what Alexander Hamilton was saying is, we have got to raise up a generation of people committed to the Christian faith who understand God's law from the Bible and understand how that relates to law and government. Otherwise, we won't preserve this Constitution, and the liberties that are secured by this Constitution will lose it. And that's exactly what has happened in the history of our country.
And I think it's so important that people understand what has been said. Those will not be ruled by God will be ruled by tyrants. Mm-hmm. William Penn had said that. But they understood that you could not have a free society unless you had people who could govern themselves and look after themselves and provide them for themselves. If people could not govern themselves and provide for themselves, why then you were going to have a government that controlled them and looked after them and provided for them. So that is what had happened down through the ages. That's why America was different. We were a nation, the only nation in all recorded history, where the founding fathers acknowledged that freedom did not come from government, from the emperor, from the dictator, from the king, from the priest. Freedom came from God. Mm-hmm. And we were to be a self-governing people. We were to be different than any other nation, and as long as we abided by that and we had Christian people in government who really believed in Jesus Christ rather than professing to believe in Jesus Christ and going to church with a Bible under their arm, like we've seen with, well, Bill Clinton always went to church with a Bible under his arm, but you didn't see that in what he did. Mm-hmm. And I fear that this is what's happened with so many of our leaders. They use Christianity. But, of course, what we need are men who fear God.
Amen. Alexander Hamilton, as you know, lost his life in a duel with Aaron Burr. Very unwise thing to engage in, but nonetheless he did. And as he was dying, it took him several days, he said, "I have a tender reliance on the mercy of the Almighty through the merits of the Lord Jesus Christ." There's a clear testimony of faith in Christ. He said, "I'm dying, and I know that I'm going to stand before the Almighty God, not in my own merits, not in anything that I have done, but only in the merit of Jesus Christ." And a clear Christian testimony. The first Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, John Jay, was also the founder and president of the American Bible Society. Can you imagine the outcry that would be taking place today if John Roberts was the founder of the American Bible Society, an organization devoted to taking the Bible, printing the Bible, and giving it to people all over the nation.
Hold that thought right there,
home.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Pastor David Whitney of the Institute of the Constitution. David, please pick up the story there.
Well, John Jay obviously was a solid Christian, and you couldn't imagine the kind of hearing he'd be going through today as the founder of the American Bible Society. Instead, we got the quibbling over whether John Roberts here believes that killing the unborn is a good thing or whether murdering the unborn is a bad thing. And, you know, it's just such a sea change that our founders wouldn't recognize the form of government that we are currently suffering under. Another great hero of our founding era was Samuel Adams, often called the father of the American Revolution. And his biographer said that he was really the last of the Puritans. He was also the governor of Massachusetts, and as governor of Massachusetts, he issued a prayer and fasting proclamation, a little different than these proclamations that are offered today, like we ought to pray, but prayer and fasting calls on people to really sacrifice and humble themselves before Almighty God. And this is what he said in that proclamation to the state of Massachusetts. I conceive that we cannot better express ourselves than by humbly supplicating the supreme ruler of the world that the rod of tyrants may be broken into pieces and the oppressed made free, that wars may cease in all the earth, and that the confusions that are and have been among the nations may be overruled by the promoting and speedily bringing on the holy and happy period when the kingdom of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ may be everywhere established and all people everywhere willingly bow to the scepter of him who is the Prince of Peace.
Now, who wrote that?
That was Samuel Adams.
Okay, well,
and that was his proclamation to the state of Massachusetts, calling them to prayer and fasting in the year 1797.
Now, wasn't he the governor of? He was the governor of the state.
Governor at that time, and so, wow, what an amazing! That's almost an altar call, calling on people to honor Jesus Christ as the ruler of the universe and the ruler of every nation.
But, you know, if somebody were to do that today, they would be attacked by both the conservative and liberal wings of the media, I should say the controlled media. Mm-hmm. And they would be certainly vilified. People would call for their impeachment. You know, today, you know, if you're in the military and you openly profess your belief in Jesus Christ, they will come after you, they will target you. And I think until people understand that there is an organized, orchestrated, coordinated effort to destroy the Christian foundation of this country and change this from a Christian nation of free men to a totalitarian, a pagan nation controlled by wicked and evil people. Until people recognize that, they can't understand literally anything that's going on in the world today. And if you read the King James Bible, you'll see frequently references to the conspiracy against God. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Pastor David Whitney of the Institute of the Constitution. And David, before we go on, I just want you to tell our listeners how they can get in touch with the Institute of the Constitution, how they can find out about the program that you have to teach people across America the very foundation of our freedom, and that is an understanding of our Constitution and its Christian foundation.
And what I'm sharing from, even in this show, is directly out of our Foundations course, Institute on the Constitution, and we offer it as a host kit. You don't actually do the teaching. Dr. John Eismo and 12 lectures, half-hour lectures on video or DVD, he does the lecturing, and the student notebook contains a very detailed outline of that. We also include a notebook for the host. We say that you're hosting, not teaching, and the host is given instructions and given the answers to questions that are asked at the end of the lecture and the test questions that are taken on the weeks between lectures. So the host has everything they need to do this in a turnkey fashion, and they can call us toll-free and order a host kit. And our toll-free number at Institute on the Constitution is 1-866-730-9796. That's 1-866-730-9796. Or actually, they can go to our website and order the same materials there. Our website is iotconline.com. That's iotconline.com. Dr. Stan is very encouraging. I'll tell you, today I was talking with a friend in South Carolina who's just begun hosting a class, and it's going very well. He's encouraged that several pastors from four different churches in the area there in South Carolina are attending his class. And he knows that as these pastors learn this material and then take it back to their congregations, it spreads a grass fire across South Carolina as more and more people become educated about the founding of our nation and about what was designed to be a Christian nation. Then we can begin taking it back bit by bit, step by step, removing those from office who oppose Christianity and placing those into office who will reinstitute what our founders originally designed, a Christian nation founded upon biblical law and government. Well, some of the other founders, just to mention Roger Sherman, who is the one who came up with the bicameral legislature, that is the House and the Senate. He came up with that compromise, and he said this, speaking about America's independence: the threatenings of the law against impenitent sinners, that's unrepentant sinners, are as important as the promises of the gospel. So he's saying a lot of people want to focus on the you know, the promises of the gospel, but they need to remember that God threatens unrepentant sinners with eternal damnation. There's a hellfire and brimstone sermon from Roger Sherman. Or how about Patrick Henry? He's one of my favorites. What a great orator and what a great leader in Virginia. And his last will and testament, this is what he wrote to his family. This is all the inheritance I can give to my dear family. The religion of Christ can give them one which will make them rich indeed. So he was witnessing to his family even after he died that what he had to leave to them was a very poor contrast with the riches that they could have in Jesus Christ. Well, just to wrap that summary up, is the overwhelming and the vast majority, with a few minor exceptions, believed the basic doctrines of Christianity, and they were active in Christian churches. And even those few, which are very few, who did not believe the basic doctrines of Christianity, nonetheless, they believed the basic values of Christianity were true and were good for society, and therefore people ought to read the Bible and study the Bible. When Thomas Jefferson was president, he was also a president of the school board of for the city of Washington, D.C. Interesting thing he did while he was president, most people don't know this, he had the Congress pass permission to print Bibles so that every single classroom in Washington, D.C. would have two essential textbooks for every classroom, the Bible and the hymn book. They were to read and learn God's truth from the Bible, and they were to sing God's praises from the hymn book. Boy, it sounds like a church service or a Sunday school class taking place in the schoolrooms of Washington, D.C. at the direct order and insistence of Thomas Jefferson. Because even though we know he wasn't an Orthodox Christian, he knew that what the Bible taught, the basic Christian values, were essential and good for society. They needed to be taught to the next generation. Wow, you wonder today, teachers are told they can't bring a Bible into class. I've had students tell me that they've been told not to bring their Bible to public schools. That they are that book is forbidden. It's considered pornography or something ridiculous like that.
Oh, you could bring in pornography. There would be no objection to pornography, but it would be the Bible. And ladies and gentlemen, we live in a world that's gone mad unless you understand that there really is an organized, orchestrated effort to destroy the Christian foundation of this nation. And not simply replace it with atheism, but with an occult religion that worships a different God. And when you understand that, then you'll begin to understand what's really going on. Go ahead.
When we look and we come to the Declaration of Independence and we begin to look at the phrases of the Declaration of Independence, it's very important to understand what those meant to our founders. Not what people today might think they mean, but what did our founders mean? And when they opened the first paragraph, when in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them. A decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. Those two phrases, the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God, are absolutely essential to understand if you're going to understand what our founders based law upon. When you ask the question, what is law? Most people say, well, you know, law is whatever a legislature passes and a governor signs and, you know, a Supreme Court says is legal. That's what law is, not according to our founders. There's an absolute standard, and that standard was the laws of nature and nature's God, and that is the foundation that they constructed our constitutional republic upon. So the question is, what do they mean by that phrase, the laws of nature and nature's God? Well, if we go back to the people that they were reading, and we know that from the Lutz Heinemann study, that they were reading Blackstone, and they were reading the Bible, and Locke, and so on, and Montesquieu, that the phrase, the laws of nature, clearly expressed both in Locke and then in Blackstone, to refer to human conscience, what Paul in Romans chapter 2, verses 14 and 15 describes, that every human being born into this world has the law of God written upon their heart. That is what we call human conscience. That you could do an experiment to find out, you know, does every human being believe that it is wrong to steal? For example, jump into an airplane, and anybody want to volunteer for this? We'll put a parachute on your back, and you pick the place. Say you pick the middle of Africa, and we'll parachute you into the middle of Africa, And once you get landed and your parachute off, the first thing you do is look for the first human being you can find. You go over to them and take something that is in their hand or on their person. Take it from them and run as fast as you can. What will happen? In whatever place of the world you drop in and do that, the same exact thing will happen. That person's going to chase you down. Why? They know the law of God, that it is wrong to steal. Thou shalt not steal has been written on their conscience, and they know it is wrong, even if they themselves are involved in violating that. So, the laws of nature, the first phrase refers to human conscience and human reason. The second phrase, very important to understand, the laws of nature's God, directly refers to what Blackstone called the very first category of law. He talked about three categories of law. The first was revealed law. Revealed law is what God revealed in His revelation, the Bible. So that second phrase of the declaration, the laws of nature's God, directly refers to the Bible. And I checked with just 2 weeks ago with constitutional law professor Dr. John Eismo and asked him about the connection of that phrase referring to the Bible, and he said, you're absolutely right. Now, the founders were not using the same phrase that William Blackstone used in his commentaries where he referred to revealed law. They used a different phrase, a parallel phrase, to the laws of nature and of nature's God. But they intended that to be understood as the Bible, and they stated very clearly in many other places. For example, George Washington said, it is impossible to rightly govern the world without God and the Bible. Wow, what an astonishing thing when today we have the supreme idiots in black robes up there saying, oh, you can't post the Ten Commandments. Oh, that would harm someone. We can't have those in public. After all, someone might venerate those ideas on the Ten Commandments. They might actually think they're the law of God. They might actually obey those Ten Commandments and decide that it's wrong to steal, that it's wrong to murder, etc. You know, we can't do that. That's impermissible. Well, our founders said that's ridiculous. That'd be like saying, okay, we're going to go down the highway here, and every posting of the speed limit, we're going to tear it down. You cannot see the law. We do not let you see the law. So when you break the law, you don't know what the law is that you're breaking anyway. Well, I would say, that's ridiculous. How can you not post the law so people can obey the law that is posted? Our founders said the Bible is the law. Matter of fact, all 13 states, when they signed this Declaration of Independence, declared their independence, they had to go back and form their own state constitutions and begin to put together the laws for their state, because now they were under their own governance, no longer under Britain. And so every state, all 13 of these new states, incorporated the Ten Commandments as law in each of those 13 states. Ten Commandments was law. It was against the law to blaspheme the name of God, against the law to break the Sabbath, against the law to commit adultery. All these things were on the book as God's law because they understood the Bible is absolute law. And this is so hard to get across to people today because they say, wait a minute, how can that be? We're not a theocracy. We never were a theocracy. And they're right. They were not forming a theocracy, but they were forming a structure of government where God's law, recorded for us in the Bible, is the supreme law above any human law. So the Constitution, in a sense, is under the law of God, the Bible, and the state laws, state constitutions, and federal laws and state laws are all under the Bible, such that any human law made which denies or rejects the law of God, recorded in the Bible, is no law at all, according to our founding fathers. Oh, Dr. Stan, how far we have gone from that worldview. We need to recover that worldview, beginning with Christians who understand this, and then spreading out to tell those who are not Christians, this is the fact. These are the historic facts. You come back and read what our founders said about this. That's what they said. If we can teach millions of Americans that, we can recover our constitutional republic out of the hands of the pagans who worship another god. They do not worship the God of the Bible, although many of them up front try to pretend they worship the God of the Bible because they know they wouldn't get elected. If they said they worshipped, Buddha or they worshipped some other god, they would never get elected in America. So they pretend to be Christians to fool the majority of Americans. But if people look at their behavior, they recognize these people are not operating under the law of God. They're walking in absolute rebellion against the law of God. They're serving another god, which is not a god at all. An idol is what they are worshiping.
Well, I think that there is a very conscious effort. I think probably no better example of this effort to destroy the religious foundation of America is that case of Stone versus Graham that took the Ten Commandments out of our schools. And this is what it said. The preeminent purpose for posting the Ten Commandments on the schoolroom walls is plainly religious in nature. The Ten Commandments are undeniably a sacred text in the Jewish and Christian faiths, and no legislative recitation of a supposed secular purpose can blind us to that fact. If the posted copies of the Ten Commandments are to have any effect at all, it would be to induce the school children to read, meditate upon, and perhaps to venerate and obey the commandments. And this is not permissible. State objective under the Establishment Clause. In other words, if they were to read them and obey the Ten Commandments, why, of course, that would be unconstitutional. So then we wonder why we have school children killing other children, why we have the anarchy in our country today, because the Supreme Court of our land did not want people to follow God's law. It's very obvious they knew exactly what they were doing. And but the trouble is that the church has not had the courage to speak out against it. You know, accepting this idea of Romans 13, that whatever the government says, why, we just have to go along with that. We can't object at all. After all, we are a law-abiding people. Well, we are a nation of laws, but we have a lawless Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. Until people understand this is what is really going on today, until people understand that is the basis of the discussion that's taking place today, we either return to a rule by law, and that law is based upon the Constitution, which limits the power of the government to say anything at all about religion. That was to be left to the states. And there really is a conspiracy against God. Once you understand that, everything that's going on makes sense. Well, David, we got about 4 or 5 minutes. You pick up.
Yes, and, you know, it's important to realize that when the change took place, which has been in the past 100 years, the past 50 years in particular, when the change took place, they had to begin to systematically propagandize the next generation. And they did this through the government school system, lying to the students, not telling the students the truth about the founding of our nation, trying to convince them that the deists were really our founders and that there was a secular purpose, not a Christian purpose in founding this nation. All those lies had to be told to an entire generation. I remember being told those lies when I was coming up through the government schools, and I had to unlearn all those lies through doing research on my own. And our purpose at Institute on the Constitution is to spread and promote the truth. And I challenge anyone who's a listener to find statements by the founding fathers that disprove what we're saying here. If you go back to the original sources, you cannot trust most of the history books that are published today, because they're published by the propagandists, the liars who are trying to persuade us that we were never a Christian nation. Study the Supreme Court decisions, like you said, Holy Trinity decision. Many other sources will demonstrate without a doubt that at least up until 1910, 20, most everyone understood. They read the history, they understood that this was a Christian nation founded upon the Bible as law. When you remove the Bible as law, the question you have to ask is, well, what is law? By what standard are you going to determine what is right and wrong if you do not have the Bible, God's revealed law, to guide you? Well, that's why we have abortion. Some 5 Supreme Court justices said, oh, yeah, killing an unborn baby? No problem. Go ahead. Now we have a judge in Florida saying, yeah, this woman's blind, which she wasn't. That was a lie. Oh, she's unable to feed herself and all these other things that were said. Her life is not worth living. Let's kill her. Now we have judges making up the law, and every American should tremble in their boots, because they should recognize that if they can kill Terri Schiavo, saying her life was not worth living, a black robe lawyer said her life is not, they can come after you as well and say, well, you're too old. Well, you don't contribute to society the way we want you to, therefore we're going to kill you.
I think they had a term for that in Hitler's Germany. It was that life which is not worth living. David, let's get your telephone number out one more time. If people would like to get in touch with you there at the Institute of the Constitution.
Our toll-free number is 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. 730-9796, or our website is iotconline.com.
And, of course, what's so vitally important is that people learn about our Constitution. They learn, really, the ideas of the men who wrote it and realize this is the permanent contract between government and people. And when government officials violate that Constitution, why, they are certainly not deserving of our support. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening. Is Pastor David Whitney of the Institute of the Constitution. We've got about 3 minutes for you to wrap up the program tonight, David.
As we look at the very first paragraph there of the Declaration of Independence, we need to remember that the Supreme Court has declared that the Declaration of Independence is the organic law of our nation. What the evildoers have tried to convince America of is that the Declaration is insignificant, it's unimportant, that the Constitution is really the important thing. But as I mentioned earlier in the program, you really cannot understand the Constitution until you understand the Declaration, because the Declaration says why, while the Constitution says how. The Declaration explains the purposes, the underlying philosophy of government, what is law. And if it's the standard of a judge, and whatever comes out of the mouth of a judge, we don't need a constitution. We don't need any laws at all. It's just whatever a judge says law is. And we know where that leads. Absolute tyranny, and the tyranny of the judiciary today, is obvious to most Americans.
David, next week will we get into the background of where these ideas of nature's God and nature's law come from, and that is really so foundational, and I hope that many people will be listening next month as we cover these ideas that were put forward by John Locke and by a man named Blackstone, whose commentaries on the laws of England really were the foundation of law here in the United States for well over 150 years. But, of course, this is not taught in our schools today. Most lawyers have never heard of Blackstone. Most lawyers have never studied the Constitution. All they've studied are the case law dealing with the Constitution. They don't understand the original intent, which is so foundational to understanding how we are losing our freedom and why we are losing our freedom. For when a nation turns against God, God eventually turns against that nation.
That's right, and so if we understand the phrase the laws of nature and nature's God, simply put it this: the laws of nature are human conscience that God has written on the heart of every human being, a conscience. They know right from wrong even if they never open the Bible. The second phrase, the laws of nature's God, refers to the Bible. In other words, everyone should know that the Bible is the foundational law book in America. It was the foundation, and if you study colonial history and you study what our founders were coming out of, they were coming out of people who studied the Bible in detail to understand what the Bible was instructing the people of Israel and how those laws applied to them today. For example, if you travel...
David, we're out of time, but we'll look forward to having you back with us again next month here at Radio Liberty.
And thank you so much, Dr. Stan.
Well, it's always a pleasure to have you, and please keep up the wonderful work as all across America, why Institutes of the Constitution are being formed. Good night.
Right.
God bless.
God bless.
You. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is really such an important issue, and once a month, why, we'll be having David Whitney with us, as we've had over the last several years. David will be here, of course, going back over the history of our Declaration of Independence, why it was written, what was in the minds of the men who wrote it, from their own words, not what you're going to get in the textbooks of today or the rewritten history, because the great tax-exempt foundations, the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Carnegie Foundation, and other people of great wealth have financed the rewriting of American history so that the American people would be deprived of an understanding of the very foundation of our freedom. What has happened has not happened by accident. And historians, researchers who try to get the truth out will find their careers very quickly ruined by those who would conceal from the American people the truth about the foundation of our freedom. So we do hope that you'll listen to Radio Liberty on a regular basis, and you can always go to my website, radioliberty.com, and of course you can find out when Pastor Whitney is going to be with us, or you can always listen to the programs. These will be recorded there. Our programs are all archived. If you go to our website, you can listen to my programs somewhere in America 5 hours a day on the internet. Now, 3 hours a day, soon to be hopefully 4 hours a day on the internet, and then on another network very early in every morning, and actually played late on that other network in the evening. That's the American Freedom Network. And we want you to listen to the programs, and we want you to tell other people about the programs. And if you'd like to get copies of the programs, you can always give us a call. The important thing is to understand that we today are involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Western civilization. If you go to our website at radioliberty.com, you can go to the section that deals with the monthly newsletter, and they go back to about 1999. And we invite you to pull down those newsletters and read them and study them and copy them and distribute them. There are letters there that deal with democracy. What is a democracy? Why did our founding fathers abhor the concept of democracy and insist that this is a republic? And you can find those newsletters listed there at our website at radioliberty.com. And we have other newsletters there going into who really rules the world. Are we simply ruled by a group of very powerful men who are elected by our citizens? Or is there some secret group that rules the world? Well, if you'd like to get a copy of my newsletter entitled The Occult Hierarchy, Part 1 or Part 2, they're both up on the internet at radioliberty.com, but if you'd like a free copy of one of our newsletters, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. We'd be glad to get your copy of our newsletter, and we hope that you'll read the newsletter and that you will get the information out. Nothing is as it appears to be. And until you understand that there is a spiritual dimension to everything going on today, until you understand we are fighting a spiritual battle on a cultural battlefield, on an ideological battlefield, on an educational battlefield, until you understand that this is really all a spiritual battle, that age-old battle between good and evil that began in the Garden of Eden, it is coming to a climax now as we move rapidly away from national sovereignty, away from having an independent nation, towards a new world order and a new world religion. And that really is what's taking place today. And so much of this information can be obtained by going to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. Pulling out our newsletters, of course, we hope that you'll copy those newsletters. We hope that you will copy many of our programs. You can actually copy the archive programs there. We archive our programs for about 6 weeks, pull them down, give them to other people. Try to get them to listen to our programs and join us in this epic struggle to determine whether this nation or any nation conceived under God can long endure. And so until tomorrow at the same time, may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. hoping to convince her that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course you're welcome to call us at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for a few minutes. We have with us this evening Ray Lair. And Ray I just talked to today, but he's been very involved in trying to understand what happened when TWA was shot down. And I guess that was 1996, wasn't it, Ray?
That's correct.
All right, fine. Now, of course, those of you who remember, there was a series of events that had happened. 1953, there was Waco. 1955, April of 1955, the Oklahoma City bombing. And then the following year, of course, that was an election year, 1996, and Bill Clinton was going to be running for re-election. And it was something fairly early, at least in the first half of the year, when Americans were horrified to find that an American airliner had been shot down, TWA Flight 800, shot down off of the east coast of the United States, just had been in the air only a few minutes coming out of the airport in New York City and headed for Europe. And, of course, there were many, many questions as to what had really happened. Well, the plane exploded in midair. And there were literally several hundred reports of people who had seen what appeared to be missiles going up to hit the plane. And there, of course, was an investigation. But the government seemed to be very intent upon convincing the American people that there really were no missiles. These people, 200 or more people who had seen the missiles going up, they were all mistaken. Actually this has been a spontaneous explosion in the central fuel tank on the airplane, and that was really what it was all about. And any talk that this had been shot down, the plane had been shot down, was simply conspiratorial. The FBI had definite evidence that this was had been a spontaneous explosion. Well, then there was a man named Jim Sanders. And he got hold of some of the fabric from the inside of the plane, from the seats of the plane, and there was residue of explosives there. And what the government did is they targeted him, and they tried to put him in prison. Why? Because he was trying to bring out the truth. They held hearings before the National Traffic Safety Board, and they would not allow any of the people who had seen the missiles go up to testify. They simply had government agents testify as to what the witnesses saw, and they simply lied. And if you haven't seen the video that Jim Sanders and his associate Jack Cashel did called Silence, why you need to get that video, it gives you an idea of the total corruption of the people at the highest levels of our government who are allowed to get up and lie under oath to deceive the American people. And with that as a background, Ray, how did you happen to get involved in trying to find out what really happened to TWA 800?
Well, I was really drawn in by an associate of mine. I spent a major portion of my career as an airline pilot working for the Airline Pilots Association, a volunteer job doing safety work. And when I retired, Captain Dick Russell took over my job. Dick Russell and I both knew an ATC representative here in Los Angeles who shortly after the accident went back to New York for a meeting, and at that meeting, several of the controllers who had been on duty that night were very upset because they had seen things on the radar that convinced them that that it was a missile, and they sent that alert all the way to the White House. Of course, it was hushed, and one of the controllers back there took a video camera, reran the radar, and
hold that thought right there, please.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest, Ray Laird. Larry, go ahead. And you were telling us that one of the controllers actually took a video camera, and he had actually, of course, they'd been watching the radar screen, and they knew what a missile looked like, and they saw, on radar, that appeared to be missiles going up to intercept a TW-800. Apparently, there were not one, but two missiles. Is that correct, Ray?
Yes, that's correct, although from what they saw, they just saw three blips on the scope. And surmised from there, I don't think they were able to differentiate two missiles at that initial time. But anyhow, one of those tapes was given to our friend in ATC, who gave it to Captain Russell. Captain Russell made copies and distributed to several of his close friends, including myself. And one of them apparently put it on the Internet, and that really started the whole furor.
Now, of course, what was basically on this videotape?
It was a tape of the aircraft in the vicinity at the time, and there were three unidentified blips, which signified a high-velocity target approaching TWA prior to the explosion.
Okay, so they actually put then the video of the radar record there up on the screen, up on the Internet.
Well, they at least indicated that that radar tape existed.
Okay, fine. So then what happened after that? Because then this arouses your suspicion that we've not been told the truth?
The follow-up to that was that Pierre Salinger, through independent sources, made a statement to the same effect. And the media beat him down and almost ruined his career. He made his career by guest lectures, etc., and they embarrassed him so much that a lot of his livelihood was cut off. But anyhow, my particular interest in the case was that I have an engineering background, and when they came to the cover-up story, why the CIA was called in, and they hypothesized that these people hadn't seen a missile. What they had seen was the aircraft itself, that after the nose was blown off of the aircraft, it pitched up and climbed from 13,800 feet up to 17,000 feet, trailing flames from the exploded fuel tank. And at the top, there was a secondary explosion, and then the airplane tipped over.
Well, that's off right there. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Ray Lair. And Ray has worked for many, many years. Were you actually a pilot yourself, Ray?
Yes, I started out in the Navy in 1943. I went with United Airlines in 1953 and retired in 1985.
Okay, fine. So you've flew for a long period of time, and then you worked for the Airline Pilots Association. And Ray was saying that to his friends, he knew that certain of the air traffic controllers who had actually witnessed what had happened had actually had some pictures. There was a video picture that showed the radar screen and showed at least three blips on it, some of them rising fast, and the air traffic controllers felt that the radar screen had shown the missiles rising up to hit TW-800. Well, then about that time, Pierre Salinger came out immediately after the downing of TW-800, and he said that he had it on a very good authority that the United States Navy had shot down TW-800. Immediately, he was attacked by the media, and of course, Pierre Salinger, as you remember, had been very close to President Kennedy, and I think he was even a United States Senator for a short period of time, but he was certainly a commentator. He was a very well-known liberal, and once he came out and suggested that the official government story of what had happened wasn't true, why he was so demonized and so attacked that his invitations that he'd had prior to that time to give speeches and talks, by which he was, of course, supplementing his income, suddenly he was just suddenly cut off. He became a non-person, which happens to anybody in this country, whether it be Dick Gregory or Pierre Salinger, and I've talked to people at the universities who've tried to tell the truth about various issues and have actually told me they've been threatened. or their careers have been destroyed. And what you know, this is really what happens when you try to get the truth out to the American people, which is why I do what I do, is trying to get people to understand that we no longer have a free society. There are people here who try to control our reality, and they do a fairly good job of it, although I think there are an awful lot of people who know that we have not gotten the truth about what really happened with TW-800. So pick up the story from there, Ray, please.
Well, yes, just prior to the first public hearing on this, James Carlstrom, the FBI director of the investigation, hosted a show on national television, and the thrust of the show was that he showed a video animation that was prepared by the CIA. Well, the CIA is known for a lot of things, but not for accident investigation.
Now, why would the CIA be involved? I mean, CIA is supposed to be involved overseas. Why would they be making up an animated replica of what happened to TWA to be shown on every television or almost every television network in America over and over and over again to shape our reality as to what happened? And this idea that after the plane exploded, the nose fell off and the plane pitched up and climbed 3,000 feet? What sort of foolishness is that?
Well, that's what aroused my interest, and I ran some calculations of my own, and I figured that the most that airplane could have climbed after that nose was blown off was about 200 feet. Well, this was confirmed by an aerodynamicist named Ed Zehr, who was also interested in this. We got to comparing notes on it, and he had essentially the same calculations I did. So I wrote letters to the NTSB and the CIA asking for the calculations that they had used for this here zoom climb. You see, after the nose was blown off, why, the only energy left really to climb altitude in such a short period of time comes from the forward velocity of the aircraft itself. The engines themselves would make an insignificant contribution to that 3,000-foot climb. And they kept putting me off, and so I submitted a Freedom of Information Act request to both the NTSB and the CIA. And NTSB, the CIA came back and said that they had researched the matter, and the data and calculations they had used came from the NTSB. The NTSB came back and said, we can't give you that information because it's proprietary to Boeing. Well, the day after this video animation was shown on national TV, Boeing came out with a public statement saying, we have no knowledge of the data used for this. What these eyewitnesses saw is best left to the eyewitnesses themselves.
And because the eyewitnesses, all of them at over 200, wasn't it, Ray?
Yes, well, there was actually about 755 eyewitnesses interviews by the FBI. Now, that's another contradiction. The NTSB is charged with the authority by Congress to conduct the investigation. But the FBI moved in and shoved them aside and didn't allow the NTSB to even participate in the interviews. And the interviews were not recorded. They weren't videotaped. All they were was little forms, 302 forms, that the FBI would fill out, and no identification even. No identification of the witnesses.
Well,
the FBI
obviously, this is a cover-up. Somebody has put orders out to the FBI, do not collect the right information, because didn't almost everybody have the same story? They saw the missiles going up?
Well, fortunately, the press got to enough of the witnesses, and a lot of the witnesses were forthcoming, so we were able to identify many of the witnesses and correlate them with the reports that the 302 reports that the FBI finally submitted to the NTSB.
And of course, we've actually talked to a number of people. Major Fitzmyer, I think, was one of them. And, of course, there was another lieutenant commander, naval commander, that we had actually talked to before he passed away. But he had investigated this, and there was no question at all that this was a great government cover-up. Because they would not allow any of the witnesses to appear before the NTSB hearings. Why? Because they would have talked about the missiles, and they couldn't let the American people know that those missiles had gone up and shot down an American plane. And once they started to lie, they had to continue the lie. Why? Because this was an election year. And, you know, Bill Clinton was running for re-election, and, of course, if there was a hint that perhaps our Navy, and, of course, we don't know who fired the missiles, we'll talk about that a little bit later, but if it was our Navy, why, you know, heads would have to roll, but you don't want to have anything happen during the election year that might turn the people against the government and Bill Clinton, who was running for re-election. On the other hand, if it was a terrorist activity, why then you'd have to ask, why are we doing anything about the terrorists? Are we going to retaliate against them? So there are lots of questions as to what happened at that time. But from your point of view, Ray, there was no question at all that the government was not telling the truth?
Well, they're certainly withholding information, and I don't believe that it was a spontaneous spark of unknown origin in the center fuel tank.
Have there ever been one before?
None that I know of. And to go back to your point about Commander Bill Donaldson, he did an outstanding amount of work. In fact, I'm just kind of following along in his footsteps. He's just a remarkable gentleman, and he did all of the real spade work. And it's still available on the web. His brother maintains the website. It's at www.twa800.com.
Give that one more time.
Sure. It's www.twa800.com.
Well, of course, I think that they hope that we'll all forget about it and go on to the next crisis that they've created. We actually have two four-tape sets on this subject, and of course they contain three or four interviews with Commander Donaldson, a very courageous gentleman who wanted to get to the truth. Well, then, of course, from your point of view, what do you think happened? Do you think that they were Navy missiles, U.S. Navy missiles? Could they have been terrorist missiles aimed at taking down the plane? Some people have suggested that that the Israeli airliner had taken off or was supposed to take off, and that many of the terrorists might have thought this was the Israeli airliner rather than the TWA airliner. The Israeli airliner had certainly gotten out of sequence there. Or is it possible, as there's stories that are put out by Jack Cashel and Jim Sanders, they wrote a book suggesting that there might have been a small plane loaded with explosives and that our government was going to take that plane down because it was headed into the United States to crash into some buildings, something of that sort. So there are all these theories out there. Do we have any idea which is the best one, or which one is the most objective?
Well, basically, there's the two schools of thought, that it was a terrorist activity or that it was accidental friendly fire. And there is some good supporters for each group. In fact, Commander Donaldson leaned towards the terrorist activity. Some of the others leaned towards accidental friendly fire. Or it might even have been a combination of the two. I mean, if we had advance notice of a terrorist activity and were trying to intercept a terrorist missile or aircraft, as Sanders has suggested, maybe we fired a missile to try to intercept a missile.
And, of course, these are the big questions. The government is not telling the truth. There's no question at all. The government officials lie. Now, if you or I were to lie, why, we would go to prison. If a government official lies and he's successful, he gets promoted and he gets a nice fat pension for it. And if you have a government that is not being forthright for the people, then no man's life or property or freedom are really safe. And this is my concern. I know the concern of many people who are investigating this sort of thing, trying to get an understanding of what's really going on today. So, where are you going at this time?
Where am I going? Well, I've been involved in a lawsuit since they denied my Freedom of Information Act requests and the appeals to those requests. I brought a lawsuit against the NTSB and against the CIA, and those, it's been going ongoing for almost 2 years in the courts right now.
Hold that thought right now. Well, why don't you go ahead and tell our listeners about your lawsuit and what you're trying to accomplish with it?
Well, basically, I'm trying to get the these agencies to release the data and calculations that they reportedly used for that Zoom crime. In my estimation, that Zoom crime never occurred.
Well, I certainly agree that, that it just is illogical to think the plane was going to fly, you know, rise at 3,000 feet. So you're trying to get them to release the information. What is their excuse for not releasing it?
Basically, they're trying to say that the data that they used was proprietary to Boeing. Well, some data might be proprietary, but the Boeing 747 is a 30-year-old design. There's any competitors of Boeing have long since garnered all of the information about that aircraft that they need. Boeing itself tried to avoid being involved in this, but there's enough pressure on Boeing and the other parties that they're unwilling to come forward and offer the information themselves.
Well, of course, were they even ever consulted, or was this thing all simply derived by the CIA to confuse and, you know, deceive the American people?
Well, Boeing was a party to the investigation. They did contribute a lot of information. There were several parties, including the Airline Pilots Association, the machinists, and FAA, and all of the people with an active interest. And Boeing did contribute information to it.
But I mean, as far as the this thesis about the climbing 3,000 feet, the plane after the nose is blown off, did Boeing in any way verify that? And are they actually involved in your lawsuit to try to get the information?
In effect, Boeing denied that hypothesis the day after it was issued, and Boeing has intervened in my lawsuit.
Now, how is Boeing intervened in the lawsuit?
They're supporting the idea that the information that they have is proprietary.
Well, you think that maybe they're doing that because they want to continue getting big, fat, lucrative government contracts?
I suspect that's it, yeah.
Well, now, has there been actually been court hearings so far?
Yes, we've had a court hearing, and that was last almost a year ago now, and no decision from the judge yet.
You mean it's taken the judge a year to come up with a decision? Do you think that that you can get an impartial decision from the judge? Why would it take a year to come up with a decision?
Actually, he split it into two separate lawsuits. We were thinking originally in terms of one lawsuit for both agencies. And so the CIA portion is still in the development phase. So I presume that he's waiting and wants to have a combined decision at the end of it all. I was frankly impressed with the judge. It's Judge Howard Matz here in Los Angeles in the Ninth Circuit. But he's under pressure, too.
Now, in what way would he be under pressure?
Well, he's a government employee.
All right, we'll be back here in just a moment. Sure. Our guest this evening is Ray Lahr. We're talking about the downing of TWA 800 and the fact that he's brought a lawsuit to try to get the information from the government about why the CIA came up with that cartoon they showed all across the country, where the figures for it came for it, and we'll be right back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Ray Lahr, and he, of course, is on the front lines of trying to get information from the government. Now, has any pressure been brought on you to try to get you to back away from this Freedom of Information Act?
No, I've never been threatened that I know of, and nobody has brought any pressure against me.
All right, so how are you managed to finance this? Are you doing this on your own? Do you have a lawyer who's helping? It must be fairly expensive to bring a lawsuit against the CIA and the National Traffic Safety Board.
Well, it is. It's run into thousands of dollars, but I have a good lawyer, John Clark, who is very dedicated, and he's working very reasonably.
All right. Well, I think it's an important thing that we try to hold our government to be accountable. The problem is, if you find out that the government officials are lying, does anything ever happen to them?
Not that I know of.
So why is it it's all right for a government official to lie, but they'll send Martha Stewart to prison for, you know, lying to an investigator?
Well, it's ethically, it should be the same, but it's much harder to bring a case against a government person, especially if they're in agencies like the CIA or the NTSB.
So don't you think that very often government agents do what they're told to do?
Oh, certainly. Yeah, these are presidential appointments for the NTSB and the head of the CIA and the FBI.
Now, what about Jim Kallstrom, who was with the FBI? Initially, he thought this was an explosion. He thought it was a terrorist attack. And then all of a sudden, his whole attitude and his whole approach changed. Do you have any idea why that was?
Well, Jack Cashel and Jim Sanders in their book say that he was called to a meeting in Washington, D.C., and apparently he got his directions there because his whole attitude changed when he came back from that meeting.
But he had already thought that this was a missile attack before that, didn't he?
Yes, he's made statements to that effect. In fact, Reed Irvine, who is the editor of AIM, Accuracy in Media, called Jim Kallstrom on the telephone and recorded the conversation. And he asked Jim Kallstrom the identity of the 30-knot ship that was underneath TWA-800 at the time. And Jim Kallstrom professed to know the identity, but refused to reveal it.
So there was a plane. Of course, we were told that there were no naval ships anywhere close at hand, that they were 100, 150 miles away. But you're suggesting that there was some sort of a naval ship there, or at least there was a ship there, and the government knew who it was and was concealing the information?
Right, exactly.
Now, why would they conceal the information? I mean, are they concealing it from Osama bin Laden? Are they concealing it from the people who were in the plane that crashed and all died? Are they concealing this information from the American people?
All of the above.
All right. Well, and of course, what's the next step as far as your lawsuit is concerned?
There's a couple of steps coming up in the next 2 months here that will take us a little bit closer to a conclusion on the CIA, and then we just have to see where it progresses from there. It's hard to predict. You know, there was a parallel lawsuit in Boston by another dedicated person back there. He was anxious to get the FBI reports on the foreign substances that were found in the victims. It looked like pellets and metallic objects were entered these bodies under tremendous force.
You're suggesting perhaps that, you know, part of a missile then.
Right, that there was an explosion within the fuselage of that aircraft that drove these things into the victims, and the FBI has refused to reveal those reports.
Why would they be afraid? If there's nothing to conceal, why would they be concealing it?
Well, that's the other ridiculous part about it. The FBI claimed that they found no evidence of criminality and withdrew from the investigation, but they refused to release any of the evidence that they gathered.
So that, of course, makes you very, very suspicious that something else is going on.
Certainly does.
Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment or two with the guest this evening, Ray Lair. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And if you have a question or comment for Ray, why, give us a call when we get back from the break. It's important that people understand that the question has not yet been answered. And of course, if this was a terrorist attack, and the government is covering up that fact, why are they covering it up? If it was a mistake from the part of our military, why not let the American people know the truth? Certainly, we acknowledge the fact that anybody can make a mistake. But why not be forthright with the government? but with the American people. And we'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Ray Lair. And, of course, he's... are you working with Jack Cashel, who's still certainly involved in this whole story?
Well, I became acquainted with Jack Cashel through Jim Sanders, and I was one of the people interviewed for that documentary that you mentioned, Silenced.
Right.
And then 2 months ago, 3 months ago now, Jack and I went over to Paris at the invitation of Michelle Priestroff to... speak with some of the press over there.
What sort of response are you getting in Europe? Do the people in Europe accept what the press here in America is saying, or are they really searching for the truth?
I believe they're searching for the truth, and Michelle lost his son on that aircraft, and he's been a real spark plug in keeping things going there.
All right, fine. So this is an issue which we should not let simply go by the wayside. I think that the people in the upper echelons of the administrations, whether they be Democrat or Republican, would like us to forget about this and move on to the next crisis. And yet, if they lied to us about TWA 800, and we know, of course, as far as the bombing of Murrah Building in Oklahoma City, the government will not release the videotapes that were taken in front of the Murrah Building on the April 19th, 1995, the date of the attack, because they claim, oh, we can't let that information out. There's still a continuing investigation. What are they investigating? You know, Timothy McVeigh has been executed. Terry Nichols is in prison. We're told they're the only two people involved, and yet we can't release the videos because there's a continuing investigation. Or is it they're covering something up? Well, we've got right now we've got Chuck calling from San Antonio. San Antonio, I assume that's in Texas. Hi, Chuck. How are you doing?
Hi. My question here is about Robert Hansen. You know, the guy that was caught spying.
Right.
He was in with Opus Dei, as was the leader of the FBI there. What was his name? Free.
No, but what does this have to do with CW 800?
With what?
Well, I'm sorry, you must be listening to another program, because we're talking about a TWA Flight 800.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
You must be... Are you listening to another program there? And
No, but I mean, y'all were talking about the FBI, and I was just curious about, you know, the relationship, but...
Really, do you have any comment at all about that sort of thing, Ray?
No, I'm not familiar with Robert Hansen.
You're right. He was part of Opus Dei, but I don't really think that is what this is, really has anything to do with this specific FBI cover. But thanks so very much for your call.
All right.
We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Ray Lair, and we're talking about the downing of TWA 800 in 1996. Now, we're going to, of course, to get Jack's impression, because Jack does have some, pardon me, Ray does have some information that he's gotten from people within the Navy. Do you want to talk at all about what you've been told by people who've been in the Navy about some of the things that gone on in that very area?
Well, one of the things we learned out of that Falkland Island War was that these Exocet missiles that the Argentinians had obtained from France came swooping in close to the water underneath the radar coverage and knocked out a couple of the British ships. And the answer to that was the implementation of a program in this country called Aegis. And the basic concept is that you have a command center. In this case, we usually use an Aegis cruiser, which is the brains. It has all of the master computers on it, and then all of the outlying satellite objects, be they ships or aircraft in the sky, with radar, relay their radar signals to the center controller, who in turn analyzes it, any threats seen on radar, and then determines which of the outlying assets is in the best position to fire an intercept missile and commands the fire of that intercept. Well, necessarily all of this has to happen in seconds, and it's all computerized. So you can see the room for error in this system. But it was being tested. This country's actually spent billions and billions of dollars on the system.
So this is on the Aegis carrier system, and of course it's intercept missiles that are fired off under computer control.
Right.
And it can be used to take down incoming missiles, either certainly intercontinental missiles or just local missiles. So it's an extremely, we're told it's an extremely accurate system.
Yes, and potentially a very effective system. But it was being tested along the Atlantic seaboard the summer of 96. In fact, it was called Global Yankee 96. It was an exercise involving other nations as well.
This was actually a naval exercise?
Right.
Okay.
And they had friendly forces and foreign forces and ran mock battles between the two of them. But the center of the Aegis evaluation was along the seaboard there, and the Wallops Island was the place that they used to fire their test missile, the target missile, and the USS Normandy is one of these Aegis cruisers, and it was active offshore.
Now, how far offshore? Do we have any idea at that time? Because we're told that the Navy said that we had no ships closer than 150 miles.
Well, that was. They later admitted that there were three submarines in the area that were closer than that.
So they really weren't telling the truth.
No, the initial statement was that. But you see, with the Aegis concept, it really doesn't matter if the Normandy was 180 miles away. Because it analyzes all of the radar data for 200 or 300 miles radius around it, and whatever asset that it wants to have a missile fired from, it just sends a radio signal and fires a missile, and the destroyer, the Aegis destroyer, can be anyplace else. So
or even a submarine then could actually put a missile up.
Right.
Okay,
right.
Go ahead.
So that is the real advantage of the system. And so at the time, they said that the U.S. Normandy was 180 miles away, and it's possibly it was, although they gave two conflicting reports, as Jack Heschel reminds us in his book, that they gave Pat Milton, the FBI gave Pat Milton information for her book, that gave the coordinates, and then also said that it was off of an inlet in New Jersey, which was only 70 miles away. So there's a latent conflict right there that apparently Pat Milton missed, and it shows the duplicity of what the Navy was passing out.
All right, fine. So then they apparently they were practicing, but were they practicing that night? Is there anything to make us suggest that this was actually some sort of a naval missile operation trial that had gone awry?
Well, to go back to my friend, he participated in the exercise that was held about a year before TWA-800, and he was on the Aegis destroyer. The missile was launched out of Wallops. The target was launched out of Wallops Island. The U.S. Normandy was the command ship, and the USS Knox was the one that fired the intercept missile. And the intercept missile rose to huge altitude, something like 179,000 feet, and only missed the target by 1,000 feet, about 8,000 feet, which it had a dummy warhead on it, so there was no explosion, of course. And but that would have been a hit.
Now, is that a nuclear nuclear warhead? Is that a conventional warhead?
Well, I imagine that it could have done it either way. And these missiles had boosters on them too to give them that altitude and range. But the intercept missile traveled on then and impacted in the warning area just south of Long Island.
Okay. And there was, isn't that fairly close to where the plane went down? How far was this? Was this off Long Island? Where did the TW-800 go down?
It was about 8 to 10 miles offshore of Long Island.
Okay.
Just along the edge of the warning area.
So we know that the Navy had been doing a trial, encounters, trial missile intercepts in that area a year before. Is there anything to suggest that it might have been more recently, that there might have been one that night?
Yes, there is a report that there was a missile fired out of Wallops Island the night of TW-800.
And where did that come from, or are you at liberty to tell that?
Well, that comes from my friend, he checked on the records, and they had all been withdrawn.
In other words, all the records had disappeared, so why would they remove the records unless, of course, they were trying to conceal something?
Right. It's all very suspicious.
All right. Well, of course, have you been able to check that with any other place, or have you been able to get that information out to the public?
No, this information I just acquired very recently about the exercise, but I put all of the information I have and all of the court documents is all on my website.
Well, how do people get there?
That's just www.raylahr.com.
All right, that's www.raylahr, and Ray, of course, is on the front lines of trying to get to the bottom of what really happened. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And I would simply point out that in a trial, if a witness gets on the stand and he lies about anything, then, of course, the opposition attorney will tend to discredit him on anything else he said. Because once you've lied about one thing, why they would anticipate that you've lost your credibility and you would lie about everything else. The tragedy is so much of what the American people are told by government officials, whether they be the president's press secretary or by official announcements from the FBI or the NTSB or the CIA, are simply lies. And if they would lie about one thing, why would we think they would ever tell the truth about anything? So I think we have to be very, very concerned. If we were to have a free society, why, it has to be where the government is forthright with the people. Have you had sort of a frustrating feeling, Ray, as you've watched this story unfold?
Oh, certainly. But, you know, I put my trust especially in, there are hundreds of eyewitnesses, but the pilot eyewitnesses, you mentioned, Major Fritz Meyer, and I've got to know Fritz fairly well since this. And Fritz was also a Navy pilot. He served over in Vietnam, flying helicopters off the back of a destroyer over there. Every time we'd have a strike over North Vietnam, why, they'd move in close, and if one of our guys went down, Fritz would be in there trying to rescue him. And he got 9 of our guys out of there. He's got all kinds of decorations. And he's seen all kinds of missiles, both theirs and ours. So when he came back, he got out of the Navy, went back, got a law degree, set up a practice on Long Island, and then they invited him to join the National Guard unit, which is just down the street from him, which he did. And on the afternoon of the accident, they called him, said that Captain Bauer here is going to lose his night refueling requalifications. If we don't get a ride for him, will you come out? So Fritz said, sure. And so they took off about 8 o'clock. It was still light. This was July 17th. So to utilize the time, why, they practiced ILS approaches at the airport there at Hampton. And Fritz had made his approach, and Captain Bauer was making an approach, and Fritz was handling the radios and looking out. The tower caller said, there's a Cessna in any traffic pattern for your runway. So Fritz is leaning forward in the cockpit trying to pick up the Cessna. And he sees a missile arc across the sky. Then he sees the bright ordnance explosion. And a second bright ordnance explosion like a flashbulb. Then he sees a big orange-red ball when the fuel tank goes up. And out of the big red ball, all of the debris falls down. Nothing went up. There was no zoom climb. And this is confirmed by other pilots. There were 3 airline crews in the air. There was a airplane coming in from Boston that had been cleared down from 21,000 feet. Captain David McLean was the pilot on this one. And it was an exceptionally clear night. He was able to pick up the lights up and down the seaboard there, and he picked up the landing light of TWA-800 as it was turning out and approaching him. TWA had been cleared up to 15,000. He'd been cleared down to 16,000 so that until after they passed, they'd have a 1,000-foot clearance. He was looking straight at the landing lights when it exploded. So what we know from that is that all the electrical system was still working when that big explosion came, that the nose was still intact. And out of the big explosion, everything fell down and separated into two flaming streams until it impacted the ocean. So his co-pilot saw that. Then there was Alitalia, which was outbound, came on. He called on the radio and reported what he had seen to ATC. Alitalia came on and confirmed, and then Virgin Atlantic came on and confirmed. So here's three airline crews. All saw this. And everything fell down. Nothing went up. There was no zoom climb.
So why would the CIA put together that animation to try to convince us that there was a zoom climb? I mean, and then why would they show it on television all across America? It was almost as if they were trying to convince the American people of something that just wasn't true. And why would the CIA be involved in a domestic operation unless this was far more than a domestic operation?
They had to have some way to discredit all those eyewitnesses. They had to have some excuse for not allowing a single eyewitness to testify at any of the public hearings.
And I think that's really what it's all about. And the American people, they like to be trusting. And yet, of course, you cannot afford to be trusting when you're dealing with matters of this significance. Our telephone number, incidentally, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you have a question on this specific subject or comment on this specific subject, we'd would like to hear from you. Certainly I think that we should never forget TW-800. And how many people died in that, do you recall?
I believe it was 230.
Right. And, of course, those people's lives were lost. And there's a conscious, organized effort to cover up what happened. Now, my understanding is that Boeing went ahead and made cash settlements with the families. But one explanation that was given for this was the fact that Boeing was told, or at least the inference was, that Boeing made a settlement with the families, admitted that it was a central fuel tank, not because they believed it was, because, of course, there'd never been another explosion in a central fuel tank throughout all the history of our country, but because, you know, if they didn't go along with the government story, why, they would not get the government contracts, and it was probably a lot cheaper to go along and get along than to do what was right and tell the truth. Now, have you heard that as a suggestion?
I've heard various things. Shortly after this, why the merger of Boeing and McDonnell Douglas was approved, and I know several engineers that say that most of the engineers in the Boeing plant don't believe the government story about the spontaneous spark of unknown origin.
You're talking about in the central fuel tank.
In the central fuel tank, yes. And the work that Commander Donaldson did, he had a long safety background in the Navy, and he actually took some of the fuel. He got permission from one of the carriers to let him tap the fuel out of that central tank. There's always a few gallons left in it. After it had been sitting on the ground in similar conditions, and found that the temperature was not what the government claimed that it would have been. But this fuel is very hard to ignite. He took some of this very same fuel, put it in a cup, and then had a lighted match, held it right over the fuel, and then dipped the flaming match into the fuel, and the liquid extinguished the flame. The only way you can really get this fuel to burn is to mist it. And if you take an atomizer, like Windex bottle and put it in there, and then spray that into a flame. Then it's very combustible. But this was the answer to the problem of combustible fuel early on, was to change the formulation so it would have this resistance to fuel tank explosions.
And, Chris, the thing is that they would not put in something that was highly explosive on those planes, because if planes were exploding in the sky, nobody would want to fly on them.
This same airplane was letting down into Rome under similar circumstances, when there was only a few gallons left in the center wing tank. It was hit by lightning. It was such a violent bolt of lightning that it popped circuit breakers and fused switches. It did damage to the whole wing that they had to leave it on the ground for several days until they could get the wing repaired. But there was no fuel explosion.
All right, we're going to be back here in just a minute to wrap up the program. Our guest this evening has been Ray Lair. And again, you want to get that website off one more time, Ray?
Yes, my website is just www.raylair.com.
Okay, we'll be back in just a moment here to wrap up the program. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest has been Ray Lair this evening. And, well, Ray, of course, you're going to hang in there and really try to get to the bottom, at least as much as you can, of what really happened. Do you think we'll ever know the real truth? Do you think anybody at a high position of government will ever come forward and really tell the truth? And if they did, what would happen to them?
Oh, I think we will eventually. You know, the Glomar Explorer was contrived by the CIA to go out there and mine nodules, cobalt nodules off the ocean floor. And they built this big, huge ship and had a whole bottom that would open up. But the whole purpose was to go out and retrieve a Russian submarine that had gone down. We knew where the submarine was. And so they went out there and grabbed it, lifted it up. Actually, one of the claws broke and lost a portion of it, including an atomic bomb. But they got a good portion of it back into the bottom of the sub, portion of the sub back into the bottom of the Global Explorer. Well, here's an example where thousands of people were involved, and it was kept in perfect secrecy for about 17 years until the story was finally released.
Well, of course, the same is true of the story of the atom bomb. Literally no one knew about the atom bomb, even though it involved thousands and thousands of people until the atom bomb was actually dropped.
Very true.
And
yes.
So they can actually, of course, conceal the truth from the American people so effectively, especially when you have the full cooperation of the media.
And one of the first things that Clinton did after this accident was withdraw the whistleblower protection. He issued an executive order which specifically told government employees that they were in deep trouble if they revealed anything.
And, of course, the thing is, if the American people can't know what their government is doing, then is the government our servant or is the government our master? And I think that's really the one of the major lessons to be learned from what's going on today. We've got to limit the power of government, take away from the ability to regulate and control the American people, or freedom, as we've known it, will soon be lost. Well, Ray, do you have a parting thought for our listeners before we let you go?
Well, I'm in wholehearted support of your quest for the truth. That's exactly what I'm looking for. I've benefited so much from this country, from my Navy experience, and parlayed that into the GI Bill and a college education, which I got me into the airlines. So I just owe this country an awful lot, and that's why I'm doing it.
Well, God bless you for everything you are doing, and perhaps we can talk to you again sometime. And if anything comes up where you know how to reach us, we'd love to have you back on again.
Thank you so much, Dr. Stan.
Good night. God bless. Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I hope you enjoyed the program this evening. We actually have several 4-tape sets on the downing of TW-800. We think it's an important subject that should not be forgotten. There's still people out there who are trying to get to the bottom of this. Certainly Jack Cashel, Jim Sanders have done a great deal of investigation. Remember that Jim Sanders actually I don't know whether he's ever sent to prison, but they almost broke him financially, tying him up in and lawsuits, and what was his crime? Why, somebody had given him a little piece of material that came from one of the seats of that plane. And, of course, it was showed, no question at all, that there were some sort of an explosive there, the sort of thing you would see from a missile. And they cannot let the American people know the truth that that would happen. Well, this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you out there will give serious consideration to helping us as we reach out 5 hours a day by radio, by internet, by satellite, and 4 hours a day on shortwave, not only across America, but across the world, trying to get people to understand that we're involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Western civilization, because behind everything that's going on today, there are powerful spiritual forces that have a different agenda, not the agenda of America, the agenda of the concept of a nation under God, where the power of government and the authority of government was to be limited and men could be live free. But the agenda of the people who control both of our political parties and our media and are the wealth of this nation and the great tax-exempt foundations and really almost every aspect of our society is to use the financial and military power of the United States to bring about a new world order and a new world religion. If you'd like to know more about how this all fits together, we hope many of you will go to our website at radioliberty.com, that's radioliberty.com, and pull down our newsletters, and you can read those newsletters, and you'll get a tremendous education as to what's really going on today. We hope that many of you will, of course, go to our section where we have our archive radio programs, and you can actually listen to most of our internet programs there, and at least the Radio Liberty programs, 3 hours a day are archived there for a matter of some weeks. And, of course, you can listen to our live programs on Radio Liberty, hopefully 4 hours a day. And then, of course, we do hope that many of you will also listen to our early morning program on the American Freedom Network. That's 7 o'clock in the morning Pacific time, and it is rebroadcast again on their website, again, in the evening. That's AFN.com, I believe it is. Anyway, you can get the exact linkage there at our website. We hope that you'll go to my website, and you can see the various stations where our program is available. There's so much up there. We have a section simply on occult symbols, and the people from the secret societies have occult symbols, which they hide in plain sight. You see them every day. Go to RadioLiberty.com and pull down that section on secret and occult symbols. And then, of course, there are several other sections there with various articles on important subjects. We hope you'll read. And, of course, you'll encourage other people to read them. But the most important thing to do would be to read my newsletters, which will take you an understanding of what was known before the 9-1-1 attack. And believe me, they did know the attack was coming. And we give you the documentation of how we know that they knew the attack was coming and what it was really all about, the history of money, the background of the foundation of our society, genetic engineering, how they, of course, create new diseases, their pop program on population control. If you haven't read my population control agenda, go to radioliberty.com. And please remember our telephone number. That's Radio Liberty. Pardon me, that's 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. Please pray for America. Pray for revival, but pray for Radio Liberty. For our provision and protection until tomorrow, may the Lord be with you.